hypocrisy in conventionalism. Any thinking person is aware of this paradox, but in dealing with conventional people, it is advantageous to treat them as though they were not hypocrites. It isn't a question of faithfulness to your own concepts. It is a matter of compromise so that you can remain an individual without the constant threat of conventional pressures. Her letter failed because she couldn't conceive of the profundity of your problem. She couldn't fathom the pressures brought to bear upon you because of environment, intellectual frustration, and a growing tendency toward isolationism. 3. She feels that A. you are leaning too heavily towards self-pity. B. that you are too calculating. C. that you are really undeserving of an 8-page letter written in between motherly duties. 4. On page 3 she writes, "I truthfully feel none of us has anyone to blame, etc." Thus vindicating those who bore influence in her formative years. But is this the whole truth? She is a wife and mother, respectable and more or less secure. It is easy to ignore the rain if you have a raincoat. But how would she feel if she were compelled to hustle her living on the streets? Would she still be all forgiving about the people in her past? Absolutely not. Nothing is more usual than to feel that others have shared in our failures, just as it is an ordinary reaction to forget those who have shared in our achievements. 5. Your sister respects your dad. She also resents the fact that you have been preferred. Her jealousy takes a subtle form in this letter. Between the lines, she is registering a question. "I love Dad and have tried to live so he could be proud to own me as his daughter, but I have had to content myself with the crumbs of his affection, because it is you he loves, and why should it be so?" Obviously, over the years, your dad has taken advantage of your sister's emotional nature via the mails. Painting a picture that justifies her opinion of him, an underdog, cursed with an ungrateful son upon whom he has showered love and concern, only to be infamously treated by that son in return. On page 7, she says she is sorry that her letter must be censored. But she is really not sorry at all. She is glad it passes through a censor. Subconsciously, she has written it with the censor in mind, hoping to convey the idea that the Smith family is really a well-ordered unit. Please do not judge us all by Perry. About the mother kissing away her child's boo-boo. This is a woman's form of sarcasm. 6. You write to her because A. you love her after a fashion. B. you feel a need for this contact with the outside world. C. you can use her. Prognosis. Correspondence between you and your sister cannot serve anything but a purely social function. Keep the theme of your letters within the scope of her understanding. Do not unburden your private conclusions. Do not put her on the defensive, and do not permit her to put you on the defensive. Respect her limitations to comprehend your objectives, and remember that she is touchy towards criticism of your dad. Be consistent in your attitude towards her, and do not add anything to the impression she has that you are weak, not because you need her goodwill, but because you can expect more letters like this, and they can only serve to increase your already dangerous antisocial instincts. Finish. As Perry continued to sort and choose, the pile of material he thought too dear to part with, even temporarily, assumed a tottering height. But what was he to do? He couldn't risk losing the bronze medal earned in Korea, or his high school diploma, issued by the Leavenworth County Board of Education as a result of his having, while in prison, resumed his long-recessed studies. Nor did he care to chance the loss of a manila envelope fat with photographs, primarily of himself, and ranging in time from a pretty little boy portrait made when he was in the Merchant Marine, and on the back of which he had scribbled 16 years old, young, happy-go-lucky, and innocent, to the recent Acapulco pictures. And there were half a hundred other items he had decided he must take with him, among them his treasure maps, Otto's sketchbook, and two thick notebooks, the thicker of which constituted his personal dictionary, a non-alphabetically listed miscellany of words he believed beautiful or useful, or at least worth memorizing. Sample page. Thanatoid. Deathlike. Omnilingual. Versed in languages. Immerse. Punishment. Amount fixed by court. Nescient. Ignorance. Ficinerous. Atrociously wicked. Hagiophobia. A morbid fear of holy places and things. Lapidicolous. Living under stones, as certain blind beetles. Dyspathy. Lack of sympathy, fellow feeling. Silifer, a fellow who fain would pass as a philosopher. Omophagia, eating raw flesh, the right of some savage tribes. Depredate, to pillage, rob, and prey upon. Aphrodisiac, a drug or the like which excites sexual desire. Megalodactylus, having abnormally large fingers. Myrtophobia, fear of night and darkness. On the cover of the second notebook, the handwriting of which he was so proud, a script abounding in curly, feminine flourishes proclaimed the contents to be the private diary of Perry Edward Smith. An inaccurate description, for it was not in the least a diary, but rather a form of anthology consisting of obscure facts. Every 15 years, Mars gets closer. 1958 is a close year. Poems and literary quotations. No man is an island entire of itself. And passages for newspapers and books paraphrased or quoted. For example, my acquaintances are many, my friends are few. Those who really know me, fewer still. Heard about a new rat poison on the market. Extremely potent, odorless, tasteless, is so completely absorbed once swallowed that no trace could ever be found in a dead body. If called upon to make a speech, I can't remember what I was going to say for the life of me. I don't think that ever before in my life have so many people been so directly responsible for my being so very, very glad. It's a wonderful moment and a rare one, and I'm certainly indebted. Thank you. Read interesting article, February issue of Man to Man. I knifed my way to a diamond pit. It is almost impossible for a man who enjoys freedom with all its prerogatives to realize what it means to be deprived of that freedom. Said by Earl Stanley Gardner. What is life? It is the flash of a firefly in the night. It is a breath of a buffalo in the wintertime. It is as the little shadow that runs across the grass and loses itself in the sunset. Said by Chief Crowfoot, Blackfoot Indian Chief. This last entry was written in red ink and decorated with a border of green ink stars. The anthologist wished to emphasize its personal significance. A breath of a buffalo in the wintertime. That exactly evoked his view of life. Why worry? What was there to sweat about? Man was nothing, a mist, a shadow absorbed by shadows. But, damn it, you do worry, scheme, fret over your fingernails and the warnings of hotel managements. Su dia termina a las 2 p.m. Dick? You hear me? Perry said. It's almost 1 o'clock. Dick was awake. He was rather more than that. He and Inez were making love. As though reciting a rosary, Dick incessantly whispered, "Is it good, baby? Is it good?" But Inez, smoking a cigarette, remained silent. The previous midnight, when Dick had brought her to the room and told Perry that she was going to sleep there, Perry, though disapproving, had acquiesced. But if they imagined that their conduct stimulated him or seemed to him anything other than a nuisance, they were wrong. Nevertheless, Perry felt sorry for Inez. She was such a stupid kid. She really believed that Dick meant to marry her and had no idea he was planning to leave Mexico that very afternoon. "Is it good, baby? Is it good?" Perry said, "For Christ's sake, Dick, hurry it up, will you? Our day ends at 2 p.m.
It was Saturday. Christmas was near, and the traffic crept along Main Street. Dewey, caught in the traffic, looked up at the holly garlands that hung above the street, swags of gala greenery trimmed with scarlet paper bells, and was reminded that he had not yet bought a single gift for his wife or his sons. His mind automatically rejected problems not concerned with the clutter case. Marie and many of their friends had begun to wonder at the completeness of his fixation. One close friend, the young lawyer Clifford R. Hope Jr., had spoken plainly. "Do you know what's happening to you, Al? Do you realize you never talk about anything else?" "Well," Dewey had replied, "that's all I think about. And there's the chance that just while talking the thing over, I'll hit on something I haven't thought of before. Some new angle. Or maybe you will. Damn it, Cliff, what do you suppose my life will be if this thing stays in the open file? Years from now, I'll still be running down tips, and every time there's a murder, a case anywhere in the country even remotely similar, I'll have to horn right in. Check. See if there could be any possible connection. But it isn't only that. The real thing is, I've come to feel I know Herb and the family better than they ever knew themselves. I'm haunted by them. I guess I always will be. Until I know what happened." Dewey's dedication to the puzzle had resulted in an uncharacteristic absent-mindedness. Only that morning Marie had asked him, please, would he please, please not forget to... But he couldn't remember, or didn't, until, free of the shopping day traffic and racing along Route 50 toward Holcomb, he passed Dr. I. E. Dale's veterinarian establishment. Of course. His wife had asked him to be sure and collect the family cat, Courthouse Pete. Pete, a tiger-striped tom weighing 15 pounds, is a well-known character around Garden City, famous for his pugnacity, which was the cause of his current hospitalization. A battle lost to a boxer dog had left him with wounds necessitating both stitches and antibiotics. Released by Dr. Dale, Pete settled down on the front seat of his owner's automobile and purred all the way to Holcomb. The detective's destination was River Valley Farm, but wanting something warm, a cup of hot coffee, he stopped off at Hartman's Cafe. "Hello, handsome," said Mrs. Hartman. "What can I do for you?" "Just coffee, ma'am." She poured a cup. "Am I wrong? Or have you lost a lot of weight?" "Some. In fact, during the past 3 weeks, Dewey had dropped 20 pounds. His suits fitted as though he had borrowed them from a stout friend, and his face, seldom suggestive of his profession, was now not at all so. It could have been that of an ascetic absorbed in occult pursuits. "How do you feel?" "Mighty fine." "You look awful." "Unarguably. But no worse than the other members of the KBI entourage, Agents Dunce, Church, and Nye. Certainly he was in better shape than Harold Nye, who, though full of flu and fever, kept reporting for duty. Among them, the four tired men had checked out some 700 tips and rumors. Dewey, for example, had spent two wearying and wasted days trying to trace that phantom pair, the Mexicans sworn by Paul Helm to have visited Mr. Clutter on the eve of the murders. "Another cup, Alvin?" "Don't guess I will." "Thank you, ma'am." But she had already fetched the pot. "It's on the house, Sheriff." "How you look, you need it." At a corner table, two whiskery ranch hands were playing checkers. One of them got up and came over to the counter where Dewey was seated. He said, "Is it true what we heard?"
"Depends."
"About that fella you caught? Prowling in the clutter house? He's the one responsible. That's what we heard."
"I think you heard wrong, old man."
"Yes, sir, I do." Although the past life of Jonathan Daniel Adrian, who was then being held in the county jail on a charge of carrying a concealed weapon, included a period of confinement as a mental patient in Topeka State Hospital, the data assembled by the investigators indicated that in relation to the Clutter case, he was guilty only of an unhappy curiosity.
"Well, if he's the wrongin', why the hell don't you find the rightin'? I got a house full of women won't go to the bathroom alone."
Dewey had become accustomed to this brand of abuse. It was a routine part of his existence. He swallowed the second cup of coffee, sighed, smiled.
"Hell, I'm not cracking jokes. I mean it. Why don't you arrest somebody? That's what you're paid for."
"Hush your meanness," said Mrs. Hartman. "We're all in the same boat. Alvin's doing good as he can."
Dewey winked at her.
"You tell him, ma'am. And much obliged for the coffee." The ranch hand waited until his quarry had reached the door, then fired a farewell volley.
"If you ever run for sheriff again, just forget my vote, 'cause you ain't gonna get it."
"Hush your meanness," said Mrs. Hartman. A mile separates River Valley Farm from Hartman's Cafe. Dewey decided to walk it. He enjoyed hiking across wheat fields. Normally, once or twice a week, he went for long walks on his own land, the well-loved piece of prairie where he had always hoped to build a house, plant trees, eventually entertain great-grandchildren. That was the dream, but it was one his wife had lately warned him she no longer shared. She had told him that never now would she consider living all alone way out there in the country. Dewey knew that even if he were to snare the murderers the next day, Marie would not change her mind. For once, an awful fate had befallen friends who lived in a lonely country house. Of course, the Clutter family were not the first persons ever murdered in Finney County, or even in Holcomb. Senior members of that small community can recall a wild goings-on of more than 40 years ago. The Hefner slaying. Mrs. Sadie Truitt, the Hamlet's septuagenarian mail messenger, who is the mother of postmistress Claire, is expert on this fabled affair. August it was, 1920. Hot as Hades. A fellow called Tuniff was working on the Finnip Ranch. Walter Tuniff. He had a car. Turned out to be stolen. Turned out he was a soldier AWOL from Fort Bliss over there in Texas. He was a rascal, sure enough, and a lot of people suspected him. So one evening, the sheriff, them days out was Orly Hefner, such a fine singer. Don't you know he's part of the heavenly choir? One evening, he rode out to the Finnip Ranch to ask Tuniff a few straightforward questions. 3rd of August. Hot as Hades. Outcome of it was Walter Tuniff shot the sheriff right through the heart. Poor Orly was gone before he hit the ground. The devil who done it, he lit out of there on one of the Finnip horses, rode east along the river. Word spread, and men from miles around made up a posse. Along about the next morning, they caught up with him. Old Walter Tuniff. He didn't get the chance to say, "How do you do?" On account of the boys were pretty irate. They just let the buckshot fly. Dewey's own initial contact with foul play in Finney County occurred in 1947. The incident is noted in his files as follows. John Carlisle Polk, a Creek Indian, 32 years of age, resident Muskogee, Oklahoma, killed Mary K. Finley, white female, 40 years of age, a waitress residing in Garden City. Polk stabbed her with the jagged neck of a beer bottle in a room in the Copeland Hotel, Garden City, Kansas, 5/9/47. A cut-and-dried description of an open-and-shut case. Of three other murders Dewey had since investigated, two were equally obvious. A pair of railroad workers robbed and killed an elderly farmer, 11-1-52. A drunken husband beat and kicked his wife to death, 6-17-56. But the third case, as it was once conversationally narrated by Dewey, was not without several original touches. It all started out at Stevens Park, where they have a bandstand, and under the bandstand, a men's room. Well, this man named Mooney was walking around the park. He was from North Carolina somewhere, just a stranger passing through town. Anyway, he went to the restroom, and somebody followed him inside. A boy from hereabouts, Wilmer Lee Stebbins, 20 years old. Afterward, Wilmer Lee always claimed Mr. Mooney made him an unnatural suggestion. And that was why he robbed Mr. Mooney and knocked him down and banged his head on the cement floor. And why, when that didn't finish him, he stuck Mr. Mooney's head in a toilet bowl and kept on flushing till he drowned him. Maybe so. But nothing can explain the rest of Wilmer Lee's behavior. First off, he buried the body a couple of miles northeast of Garden City. Next day, he dug it up and put it down 14 miles the other direction. Well, it went on like that, burying and reburying. Wilmer Lee was like a dog with a bone. He just wouldn't let Mr. Mooney rest in peace. Finally, he dug one grave too many. Somebody saw him. Prior to the clutter mystery, the four cases cited were the sum of Dewey's experience with murder, and measured against the case confronting him, were as squalls preceding a hurricane. Dewey fitted a key into the front door of the clutter house. Inside, the house was warm, for the heat had not been turned off, and the shiny floored rooms, smelling of a lemon-scented polish, seemed only temporarily untenanted. It was as though today were Sunday and the family might at any moment return from church. The heirs, Mrs. English and Mrs. Jarchow, had removed a vanload of clothing and furniture, yet the atmosphere of a house still humanly inhabited had not thereby been diminished. In the parlor, a sheet of music, Coming Through the Rye, stood open on the piano rack. In the hall, a sweat-stained gray Stetson hat, Herb's, hung on a hat peg. Upstairs in Kenyon's room, on a shelf above his bed, the lenses of the dead boy's spectacles gleamed with reflected light. The detective moved from room to room. He had toured the house many times. Indeed, he went out there almost every day, and in one sense could be said to find these visits pleasurable, for the place, unlike his own home, or the sheriff's office with its hullabaloo, was peaceful. The telephones, their wires still severed, were silent. The great quiet of the prairies surrounded him. He could sit in Herb's parlor rocking chair and rock and think. A few of his conclusions were unshakable. He believed that the death of Herb Clutter had been the criminal's main objective, the motive being a psychopathic hatred, or possibly a combination of hatred and thievery, and he believed that the commission of the murders had been a leisurely labor, with perhaps two or more hours elapsing between the entrance of the killers and their exit. The coroner, Dr. Robert Fenton, reported an appreciable difference in the body temperatures of the victims, and, on this basis, theorized that the order of execution had been Mrs. Clutter, Nancy, Kenyon, and Mr. Clutter. Attendant upon these beliefs was his conviction that the family had known very well the persons who destroyed them. During this visit, Dewey paused at an upstairs window, his attention caught by something seen in the near distance, a scarecrow amid the wheat stubble. The scarecrow wore a man's hunting cap and a dress of weather-faded flowered calico. Surely an old dress of Bonnie Clutter's? Wind frolicked the skirt and made the scarecrow sway, made it seem a creature forlornly dancing in the cold December field. And Dewey was somehow reminded of Marie's dream. One recent morning she had served him a bungled breakfast of sugared eggs and salted coffee, then blamed it all on a silly dream. But a dream the power of daylight had not dispersed.
It was so real, Alvin, she said. As real as this kitchen. That's where I was. Here in the kitchen. I was cooking supper, and suddenly Bonnie walked through the door. She was wearing a blue Angora sweater, and she looked so sweet and pretty. And I said, oh, Bonnie, Bonnie, dear, I haven't seen you since that terrible thing happened. But she didn't answer, only looked at me in that shy way of hers, and I didn't know how to go on, under the circumstances. So I said, honey, come see what I'm making Alvin for his supper. A pot of gumbo, with shrimp and fresh crabs. It's just about ready. Come on, honey, have a taste. But she wouldn't. She stayed by the door looking at me. And then, I don't know how to tell you exactly, but she shut her eyes. She began to shake her head very slowly and wring her hands very slowly and to whimper or whisper. I couldn't understand what she was saying, but it broke my heart. I never felt so sorry for anyone, and I hugged her. I said, please, Bonnie. Oh, don't, darling, don't. If ever anyone was prepared to go to God, it was you, Bonnie. But I couldn't comfort her. She shook her head and wrung her hands, and then I heard what she was saying. She was saying, to be murdered. To be murdered. No. No. There's nothing worse. Nothing worse than that. Nothing. It was midday deep in the Mojave Desert. Perry, sitting on a straw suitcase, was playing a harmonica. Dick was standing at the side of a black surfaced highway, Route 66, his eyes fixed upon the immaculate emptiness as though the fervor of his gaze could force motorists to materialize. Few did, and none of those stopped for the hitchhikers. One truck driver, bound for Needles, California, had offered a lift, but Dick had declined. That was not the sort of setup he and Perry wanted. They were waiting for some solitary traveler in a decent car and with money in his billfold, a stranger to rob, strangle, discard on the desert. In the desert, sound often precedes sight. Dick heard the dim vibrations of an oncoming, not yet visible car. Perry heard it too. He put the harmonica in his pocket, picked up the straw suitcase. This, their only luggage, bulged and sagged with the weight of Perry's souvenirs, plus three shirts, five pairs of white socks, a box of aspirin, a bottle of tequila, scissors, a safety razor, and a fingernail file. All their other belongings had either been pawned or been left with the Mexican bartender or been shipped to Las Vegas, and joined Dick at the side of the road. They watched. Now the car appeared and grew until it became a blue Dodge sedan with a single passenger, a bald, skinny man. Perfect. Dick raised his hand and waved. The Dodge slowed down and Dick gave the man a sumptuous smile. The car almost, but not quite, came to a stop, and the driver leaned out the window, looking them up and down. The impression they made was evidently alarming. After a 50-hour bus ride from Mexico City to Barstow, California, and half a day of trekking across the Mojave, both hikers were bearded, stark, dusty figures. The car leaped forward and sped on. Dick cupped his hands around his mouth and called out, "You're a lucky bastard!" Then he laughed and hoisted the suitcase to his shoulder. Nothing could get him really angry, because, as he later recalled, he was too glad to be back in the good old USA. Anyway, another man in another car would come along. Perry produced his harmonica. His since yesterday, when he stole it from a Barstow variety store, and played the opening bars of what had come to be their marching music. The song was one of Perry's favorites, and he had taught Dick all five stanzas. In step, and side by side, they swung along the highway, singing, "Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored." Through the silence of the desert, their hard, young voices rang, "Glory, glory, hallelujah! Glory, glory, hallelujah!"
Part 3. Answer. The young man's name was Floyd Wells, and he was short and nearly chinless. He had attempted several careers, as soldier, ranch hand, mechanic, thief, the last of which had earned him a sentence of 3 to 5 years in Kansas State Penitentiary. On the evening of Tuesday, November 17th, 1959, he was lying in his cell with a pair of radio earphones clamped to his head. He was listening to a news broadcast, but the announcer's voice and the drabness of the day's events. Chancellor Konrad Adenauer arrived in London today for talks with Prime Minister Harold Macmillan. President Eisenhower put in 70 minutes going over space problems and the budget for space exploration with Dr. T. Keith Glennon were luring him toward sleep. His drowsiness instantly vanished when he heard, "Officers investigating the tragic slaying of 4 members of the Herbert W. Clutter family have appealed to the public for any information which might aid in solving this baffling crime. Clutter, his wife, and their 2 teenage children were found murdered in their farm home near Garden City early last Sunday morning. Each had been bound, gagged, and shot through the head with a 12-gauge shotgun. Investigating officials admit they can discover no motive for the crime, termed by Logan Sanford, director of the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, as the most vicious in the history of Kansas. Clutter, a prominent wheat grower and former Eisenhower appointee to the Federal Farm Credit Board." Wells was stunned. As he was eventually to describe his reaction, he didn't hardly believe it. Yet he had good reason to, for not only had he known the murdered family, he knew very well who had murdered them. It had begun a long time ago, 11 years ago, in the autumn of 1948, when Wells was 19. He was sort of drifting around the country, taking jobs as they came, as he recalled it. One way and another, I found myself out there in western Kansas, near the Colorado border. I was hunting work and asking round. I heard maybe they could use a hand over to River Valley Farm. That's how he called this place, Mr. Clutter did. Sure enough, he put me on. I stayed there, I guess, a year. All that winter, anyway. And when I left, it was just 'cause I was feeling kinda footy. Wanted to move on. Not account of any quarrel with Mr. Clutter. He treated me fine, same as he treated everybody that worked for him. Like, if you was a little short before payday, he'd always hand you a 10 or a 5. He paid good wages, and if you deserved it, he was quick to give you a bonus. The fact is, I liked Mr. Clutter much as any man I ever met. The whole family. Mrs. Clutter and the 4 kids. When I knew them, the youngest 2, the ones that got killed, Nancy and the little boy wore glasses. They were only babies, maybe 5 or 6 years old. The other 2, one was called Beverly. The other girl, I don't remember her name. They were already in high school. A nice family. Real nice. I never forgot them. When I left there, it was sometime in 1949. I got married. I got divorced. The army took me. Other stuff happened. Time went by, you might say, and in 1959,
June 1959. 10 years since I last seen Mr. Clutter. I got sent to Lansing. Because of breaking into this appliance store. Electrical appliances. What I had in mind was I wanted to get hold of some electrical lawnmowers. Not to sell. I was going to start a lawnmower rental service. That way, see, I'd have had my own permanent little business. Of course, nothing come of it. Except I drew a 3 to 5. If I hadn't, then I never would have met Dick. And maybe Mr. Clutter wouldn't be in his grave. But there you are. There it is. I come to meet Dick. He was the first fella I sailed with. We sailed together, I guess, a month. June and part of July. He was just finishing a 3 to 5. Due for parole in August. He talked a lot about what he planned to do when he got out. Said he thought he might go to Nevada, one of them missile-based towns, buy himself a uniform and pass himself off as an Air Force officer, so he could hang out a regular wash line of hot paper. That was one idea he told me. Never thought much of it myself. He was smart, I don't deny, but he didn't look the part, like no Air Force officer. Other times he mentioned this friend of his, Perry, a half-Indian fella he used to sail with, and the big deals him and Perry might pull when they got together again. I never met him, Perry. Never saw him. He'd already left Lansing, was out on parole. But Dick always said if the chance of a real big score came up, he could rely on Perry Smith to go partners. I don't exactly recall how Mr. Clutter first got mentioned. It must have been when we were discussing jobs, different kinds of work we'd done. Dick, he was a trained car mechanic, and mostly that was the work he'd done. Only once he'd had a job driving a hospital ambulance. He was full of brag about that. About nurses and all what he'd done with them in the back of the ambulance. Anyway, I informed him how I'd worked a year on a considerable wheat spread in western Kansas. For Mr. Clutter. He wanted to know if Mr. Clutter was a wealthy man. Yes, I said. Yes, he was. In fact, I said, Mr. Clutter had once told me that he got rid of $10,000 in 1 week. I mean, said it sometimes cost him $10,000 a week to run his operation. After that, Dick never stopped asking me about the family. How many was they? What ages would the kids be now? Exactly how did you get to the house? How was it laid out? Did Mr. Clutter keep us safe? I won't deny it. I told him he did. Because I seemed to remember a sort of cabinet, or safe, or something, right behind the desk in the room Mr. Clutter used as an office. Next thing I knew, Dick was talking about killing Mr. Clutter. Said him and Perry was gonna go out there and rob the place. And they was gonna kill all witnesses. The Clutters, and anybody else that happened to be around. He described to me a dozen times how he was gonna do it. How him and Perry was gonna tie them people up and gun them down. I told him, Dick, you'll never get by with it. But I can't honestly say I tried to persuade him different. Because I never for a minute believed he meant to carry it out. I thought it was just talk. Like you hear plenty of in Lansing. That's about all you do here. What a fella's gonna do when he gets out. The hold-ups and robberies and so forth. It's nothing but brag, mostly. Nobody takes it serious. That's why. When I heard what I heard on the earphones, well, I didn't hardly believe it. Still and all, it happened. Just like Dick said it would.
That was Floyd Wells' story, though as yet he was far from telling it. He was afraid to, for if the other prisoners heard of his bearing tales to the warden, then his life, as he put it, wouldn't be worth a dead coyote. A week passed. He monitored the radio, he followed the newspaper accounts, and in one of them read that a Kansas paper, the Hutchinson News, was offering a reward of $1,000 for any information leading to the capture and conviction of the person or persons guilty of the Clutter murders. An interesting item. It almost inspired Wells to speak. But he was still too much afraid, and his fear was not solely of the other prisoners. There was also the chance that the authorities might charge him with being an accessory to the crime. After all, it was he who had guided Dick to the Clutter's door. Certainly, it could be claimed that he had been aware of Dick's intentions. However one viewed it, his situation was curious, his excuses questionable. So he said nothing, and 10 more days went by. December replaced November, and those investigating the case remained, according to increasingly brief newspaper reports. Radio newscasters had ceased to mention the subject, as bewildered, as virtually clueless as they had been the morning of the tragic discovery. But he knew. Presently, tortured by a need to tell somebody, he confided in another prisoner. A particular friend. A Catholic. Kinda very religious. He asked me, "Well, what are you gonna do, Floyd?" I said, "Well, I didn't rightly know. What did he think I ought to do?" Well, he was all for me going to the proper people. Said he didn't think I ought to live with something like that on my mind. And he said I could do it without anybody inside guessing I was the one told. Said he'd fix it. So the next day he got word to the deputy warden. Told him I wanted to be called out. Told the deputy if he called me to his office on some pretext or other, maybe I could tell him who killed the Clutters. Sure enough, the deputy sent for me. I was scared. But I remembered Mr. Clutter, and how he'd never done me no harm. How at Christmas he'd give me a little purse with $50 in it. I talked to the deputy. Then I told the warden himself. And while I was still sitting there, right there in Warden Hand's office, he picked up the telephone. The person to whom Warden Hand telephoned was Logan Sanford. Sanford listened, hung up, issued several orders, then placed a call of his own to Alvin Dewey. That evening, when Dewey left his office in the courthouse at Garden City, he took home with him a manila envelope. When Dewey got home, Marie was in the kitchen preparing supper. The moment he appeared, she launched into an account of household upsets. The family cat had attacked the cocker spaniel that lived across the street, and now it seemed as if one of the spaniel's eyes might be seriously damaged. And Paul, their 9-year-old, had fallen out of a tree. It was a wonder he was alive. And then their 12-year-old, Dewey's namesake, had gone into the yard to burn rubbish and started a blaze that had threatened the neighborhood. Someone, she didn't know who, had actually called the fire department. While his wife described these unhappy episodes, Dewey poured 2 cups of coffee. Suddenly, Marie stopped in the middle of a sentence and stared at him. His face was flushed, and she could tell that he was elated. She said, "Alvin, oh, honey, is it good news?" Without comment, he gave her the manila envelope. Her hands were wet. She dried them, sat down at the kitchen table, sipped her coffee, opened the envelope, and took out photographs of a blonde young man and a dark-haired, dark-skinned young man. Police-made mugshots. A pair of semi-coded dossiers accompanied the photographs. The one for the fair-headed man read, "Hickok, Richard Eugene, white male, 28, KBI-97093. FBI-859273A. Address, Edgerton, Kansas. Birthdate, 6-6-31. Birthplace, KC, Kansas.